Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. 6%, that's how much the cost of health plans offered by Covered California are expected to go up next year. And that's just the average. There are some parts of the state where rates will likely increase by double digits, upwards of 11%. And if federal funding isn't renewed, health insurance marketplaces across the country like Covered California may push rates even higher. And yet another piece, as more people resume doctor medical appointments at this stage in the pandemic, costs to see a physician, like pretty much everything else these days, are going up. Inflation is also having an impact. There's also another big change at Covered California this year. For the first time since the state health insurance marketplace launched in 2012, Covered California has a new leader. Joining us now is the new executive director, Jessica Altman. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, for those who still may be unfamiliar with Covered California or who may be considering it for the first time, walk our listeners through what it is and how it works.
Yeah, so Covered California is California's marketplace for health insurance. It's the only place that Californians can go to receive financial assistance for purchasing health insurance from the companies. You know, we have 13 different insurers offering coverage on Covered California next year, and buy that coverage. We are really the place that people can go for health insurance if they don't have health insurance from another source. If you're not getting it from your employer, from a spouse or a parent, and you're not eligible for Medicaid or old enough to get on Medicare or have access for another reason, Covered California can be your home for coverage.
And there are roughly 1.7 million enrollees right now?
That's right.
So that's about 5% of Californians enrolled in health insurance currently. Well, Covered California just announced that on average rates are going to be going up by 6%. And that is significant considering looking back the last couple years, rates held relatively steady, going up on average about 1% in 2020, 2021, 2022. So why such an increase?
Yeah, I think there are a few important things here. One is we all know the pandemic has had a lot of effects on our lives in different ways. And one of those impacts in our society has been on healthcare costs. We've seen some abnormal trends in recent years. Elective procedures weren't happening for a period of time. People are or had been skipping in-person visits and things like that. And so what we actually saw is the last few years were an unusually low rise in healthcare costs. And what we're seeing this year is kind of this return to more normal patterns of the use of healthcare. And that's happening around the country. Actually, before California released our rates, the national average was 10%. And so there are a lot of factors about California. Covered California negotiates very actively with our health plans. We are a large and healthy risk pool that's actually keeping us lower than what other states are seeing around the country. So that's the largest reason for that 6%.
If healthcare costs are going up across the board, there are some pretty extreme outliers in that increase. You go to some counties like Fresno, Madera, and Kings County, where their average are going to have a 0% increase. But then on the other end, you have other counties like Alpine, Calaveras, Inyo, Mono counties that can see upwards of 11%. What's accounting for that difference in California?
Yeah, so I want to just start with one comment here, which we'll talk more about later, which is rates and premiums are a really important measure of healthcare costs and what's how they're changing over time. And we know we have a problem with that in this country. But on Covered California, we have financial assistance available. And in the vast majority of situations, particularly if we get to maintain the financial assistance we have today, people are going to be protected from these changes through that structure. But to answer your question directly, we also know healthcare costs vary significantly from community to community. The competitive dynamics are different. There are different numbers of hospitals, numbers of insurers, different relationships that every year result in variances of cost changes and underlying costs that are the baseline of those changes as well. So it's not surprising to see that variation.
You know, and I do understand that there's financial assistance, you know, offered to some enrollees. And I think a piece of that also involves Covered California receives federal subsidies, and they are scheduled to expire at the end of the year. Can you explain how much is really like pumped into Covered California from the federal government?
Yeah, so Cover California was created by the Affordable Care Act and from the beginning has provided financial assistance to its members and will continue to. But what is in question in Congress right now, a very active discussion this week, is whether or not to continue enhanced financial assistance made available during the pandemic. So basically, providing more financial assistance than we were before, providing financial assistance who were not to individuals who were not previously eligible. So the winds in D.C. are favorable this week, but it's not certain. So we're watching that very, very closely to see what that impact will be. But I do want to be clear, it is not on the table for all financial assistance to go away, just whether we'll get to maintain these enhancements to the structure.
So if Congress does pull back funding in that hypothetical scenario, the state of California also has some money set aside, right, in the budget to fund Covered California. So how much money is that? And would that be enough to stave off additional rate hikes and if Congress pulls back some funding?
Yeah. So the enhanced subsidies are worth about $1.7 billion to California. So that's on an annual basis. Governor Newsom and the legislature through the budget process have stepped up, the only state in the country to do this, and said, if that funding is not made available, we are going to put forward some state dollars to try and mitigate some of that impact. That's just over $300 million. So it will not fill the hole that would be left by the federal government, but it would be incredibly meaningful in terms of, again, mitigating some of those price increases, which in some cases would be significant.
Given that there's 1.7 million Californians who are currently taking part in Covered California, are you concerned that that number will be impacted if Congress doesn't come through?
Yeah, so we estimate that if we don't see these enhanced subsidies continue, that there are 220,000 Californians who would be priced out of coverage. That's an incredibly significant number, particularly given all of the other things we know are happening in the world, the cost increases that are impacting people for their basic goods, for food, for, you know, due to inflation and what's happening with the economy. So it's certainly not an outcome that we would like to see.
When we're talking about the 6% average increase in rates projected for next year, going into this, was that a projection for Covered California? I mean, looking at the 2023 potential rates, given that the average rate increase for the last 3 years was, you know, around 1%.
Yeah, so we don't do projections of annual rates, but I'll tell you, and, you know, I come to California from another state where I was overseeing the rate process there. So I know the national dynamics really well. So while we didn't have a prediction here, I can tell you I'm not surprised by it, because as you look at these national trends impacting the cost of healthcare that we talked about, that we were seeing that data come in throughout the past year. So again, didn't have a prediction, but not surprised.
Another factor in this is Covered California enrollment is coming up, and there are actually more insurers that are joining the exchange, which seems like good news. What do people here in Sacramento and Northern California need to know about the addition of options?
Yeah. So we are, for the first time in a number of years, bringing a new insurer onto Covered California who will be in the Sacramento region. That insurer is Aetna CVS, so a familiar name to many, but hasn't been on Covered California before. They'll be entering in a few regions. We do also have some of our existing insurers expanding where they're offering, although that's not directly impacting the Sacramento region. So again, indicative of overall, we have this competitive market. We're offering choices. We'll have 13 insurers. The vast majority of Californians have access to more than three or four insurers, and everyone has access to at least two.
What is the benefit of going through the marketplace at Covered California as opposed to just going directly with the insurer?
Again, we are the only place in California where you can go to access the financial assistance, and financial assistance will continue to be available no matter what. It's just how much of that assistance that we have to offer. And what that really does at the end of the day is look at what you should pay, what you and your family should pay for your health insurance is going to be based off of a percent of your income rather than what price the insurance company is charging that year. So again, that goes back to what I said. It's actually going to be a bigger impact on what people pay, whether Congress extends this enhanced financial assistance than the underlying premium increase because of that subsidy structure and the way it's set up to say, hey, you should really only have to pay this much of your income. And under the enhanced subsidies, no Californian should have to pay more than 8.5% of their income for the core basic plan offered on Covered California.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Covered California's executive director, Jessica Altman, about the expected rate increases coming for 2023. Jessica, you took over just a few months ago, earlier this year, after Peter Lee from Covered California announced he was leaving. What do you think you can improve on immediately in the next year here in California?
Yeah, so Covered California is an exceptional organization that has made exceptional progress in partnership with the state in lowering the uninsured rate. So it's not really about improving anything or fixing anything that's wrong. It's about building on the incredible progress that we have made, continuing to chip away at that uninsured rate here in the state, continuing to offer affordable coverage. And we're really focused on also moving beyond just, do people have health insurance, to what is that health insurance offering people? Is the access there? Is the care that is accessible higher quality? We have new requirements in our contracts this year for the first time that are having our insurers put money on the table for actually delivering quality care and making improvements. And we're looking at that not just across the board, but also with that lens of also trying to be more equitable in our care. Is that impacting all of our communities, all of our populations positively in the same manner? So that, in addition to always continuing our work to reach every corner of the state to make what is a very complicated healthcare system easier and simpler to navigate to help people in those transitions. You know, Covered California, you said earlier, we're about 5% of the state. That's true. But our population is constantly changing and people will need us at different points in their lives, whether they're losing coverage from a job, trying to start their own business, retiring early, aging off of their parents' plans, right? All of these circumstances are where they're going to come to us, sometimes for a long period of time and sometimes for a short period of time. So we want to make that as simple, and we want people to know that we're who you call if you're in those circumstances.
I mean, you just said yourself, it's a complicated set of issues. It's very layered. And also there is that operative word of equity. Would you say achieving that equity is one of the most challenging parts of this job when it comes to the marketplace?
It's incredibly challenging, and not just for the marketplace, for anybody in healthcare, because there are so many complex elements of our society that are impacting equity, that are causing disparities in healthcare. And it's going to take a multifaceted approach across our healthcare system to really tackle those disparities in a comprehensive way. And that's why Covered California is certainly not the only entity in the state looking to improve equity. You see great commitment from the governor, great incredible investments through CalAIM, through the Medi-Cal program, to really look at the social drivers of health, and a collaborative, committed, coordinated effort from all of us in the state, the providers, the insurers, to move that needle.
How do you foresee healthcare evolving?
In so many ways, it's a broad question. I think what is so exciting here in California is what we are trying to evolve to is universal coverage and access. And that can take different shapes. That's certainly a live discussion here. But what we want to do, again, is make sure that every person residing in our state can access the care that they need, can access coverage. And it's really exciting to get to be a part of that here in California.
What conversations are taking place to get more specific? As you know, we have a population of 40 million plus people, but also a rapidly aging population as well.
Yeah, so there are, first of all, of course, we have the Medicare program here.
Yes.
Nationally, that provides insurance coverage to individuals 65 and older. That is continuing. There also is access to the Medi-Cal program for our lowest income seniors, and a lot of efforts there to improve access to services around long-term services and supports for those that need those services. I will say at Covered California, because of the Medicare program, we largely don't cover seniors or those that need long-term services and support. So in many ways, I may not be the best person to speak to those issues.
Mm. Would you be impacted by it, though, given that we do have an aging population and we're all going to the same hospitals and getting health care? And we were just talking about how health care costs are going up, which is then Covered California and ratepayers are going to have to shoulder that increase. Like, we're not in a vacuum.
we're not in a vacuum, and healthcare costs certainly impact all of us in healthcare. And it's actually a great thread to pick up as we think about efforts that are ongoing here in California. It's not just about coverage. It's not just about sort of saying, well, it's expensive, so we'll subsidize it more. It's about how can we tackle the underlying healthcare costs. And again, some exciting movement in California this year to see the Office of Healthcare Affordability move forward that is going to be really looking under the hood at how those healthcare costs are changing. And Cover California, we're excited to partner with them as they get that work off the ground and see how we can be a partner in that broader effort to reduce healthcare costs across the board.
I'm curious, you come from the Bay Area. You're a California native, but you also spent a lot of time around the country. You were Pennsylvania's insurance commissioner before taking Covered California's top position. What makes healthcare unique in California with that perspective?
So, I mean, the one thing that's the same about healthcare everywhere is that it's core to our ability to live happy and healthy lives. But that looks really different in different states. It would be no surprise to those listening today that the politics in Pennsylvania are very different than the dynamics here in California. And for me, making that transition, what is so exciting here is all of us are rowing in the same direction, right? There's a deep commitment to expanding care, to improving equity, to achieving universal coverage, and it's not about if we do that, it's about how we do that and how we do that together. And that's why, again, it's such a privilege to be back here in my home state of California doing that work.
Finally, Jessica, what should Californians need to know about open enrollment coming up for Covered California?
Yeah, so open enrollment, as always, begins on November 1st. We will begin communicating to those of you who are enrolled in California in October, as will your insurance company. So keep an eye out for that. Given our conversation today, I just want to really stress get accurate information, to come in and check. The conversation in DC about extending this financial assistance is live, and we will see what happens in the next few weeks. But I am hopeful that we will have an extension of this financial assistance, and we will be able to continue to deliver the record affordability that brought us also to record enrollment coming out of last year during this pandemic when healthcare is front of mind, and during a time with inflation and the state of the economy when costs are front of mind. So don't let conversations about prices going up have you sort of not even check, because we could be in a really good place come November. And if you don't have coverage, now is the time. November is the time to take that moment to explore your options and see. So many people come to Covered California and say, I don't think I'm going to be able to afford it, only to go through the process and say, oh my gosh, it is more affordable than I ever thought it would be. And I've seen that time and time again. So if I were to give one message, if you're uninsured, that could be you.
Jessica Altman is the new executive director for Covered California. We appreciate the time, Jessica. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It's been 10 years since Stockton filed bankruptcy, the largest municipality to do so at the time. Detroit would file bankruptcy the following year. During the 2008 recession, a perfect financial storm hit cities like Stockton hard. Foreclosures, declining home values, loose spending, and not planning for a negative downturn. Stockton is one of the most diverse cities in the country, yet is often used as a headline as poverty-stricken and a high-crime place. But headlines are just that, headlines, and there is, of course, more to the story. Michelle Wild Anderson is an urban law professor at Stanford University. Her new book, The Fight to Save the Town, documents the dismantling and rebuilding of local government in high poverty communities. Professor Anderson helps us unpack what happened in Stockton and how residents are reinventing their city. Michelle, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm so glad to be here, Vicki.
Happy to have you. When did you begin working on this book?
During the recession, so many local governments started to go broke. Stockton was just one of them, as you described it. And as that began happening across the country, I started learning about the weakness in our urban governments and just how many places had not only an emergency budget situation, but a multi-generational budget problem. So I started to see all of the places around the country that had this chronic decline problem.
In your book, you highlight four places that have their own unique characteristics, their own demographics, their own political views of the role of government, as well as their own financial challenges. There's Josephine County in Oregon, which is near the California border, Detroit, Lawrence, Massachusetts, near New Hampshire, and of course, Stockton. How are these places different and how are they the same?
Great. Yeah. The book focuses on places that are poor and also broke. And they're broke in part because they're poor, and they're poor in part because they're broke. So it's this sort of negative cycle that unites these places. But I also chose them in the book because they're so different from each other, as you described. So they're politically different from each other. They're racially different from each other. They run from very rural to big city urban. And in those differences, you really get a sense for the national problem and the way that a lot of different local histories can converge on this same kind of challenge.
Given that you titled the book, The Fight to Save the Town, Reimagining Discarded America, at what point in your research and in your journey did you come to this title?
Oh, that's such a lovely question. You know, early titles for the book were much more bleak. I won't say them out loud because they were really pretty bad. But at one point, I really decided that we don't have enough time for problem-focused writing anymore. There's just so much to do. And there are incredible people in cities like Stockton that are already working on these problems. And I wanted to write a book focused on them. I wanted them to be the experts and really to share the stories of progress that they're fighting so hard for. And I love that word fight because it is really hard work and the kind of resilience and tenacity it takes to encourage to show up for really difficult problems, you know, deserves a strong word like fight. So the title sort of emerged from a larger transformation to really focus not only on the underlying problems, but really on the people driving solutions.
Yeah, the word fight is definitely operative, but also what struck me was the word discarded, you know, to get rid of something that is no longer useful or desirable. What led to you choosing that specific word?
It's also such a good question. I like the word discarded because, like you say, it captures throwing something away. And I think a lot of these places, we want to just throw them away. We want to make them go away. And yet huge swaths of the country have this kind of problem. I mean, the American economy right now is spatially polarized, which is a wonky way of saying that we have these giant metro engines that are driving huge regional economies. And those big metro nodes of economic activity that we're all so familiar with in the Bay Area are places with lots of jobs, but not enough housing. So it's hard to make a living in that sense. But then there's even bigger areas of the country with a majority of our national population that have the opposite problem, not enough jobs and sometimes surplus housing, although costs are rising there too. And the this word discarded to me captures that I think at some level we've had really since the end of the 80s, we've had this kind of willful blindness about this larger problem and really told ourselves this story that struggling places needed to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and figure it out. And these problems get worse when you leave them intergenerationally. Hmm. So I like the active sort of suggestion that we've not only sort of neglected these areas, we kind of tried to throw them away or push them out of our politics.
Stockton has a rich history that I think deserves a reminder, even just, you know, a first time lesson. What did you learn about the city's foundation and the early settlers that created such a diverse place?
You know, Stockton is the most diverse city in America. And I feel like we should just have a pregnant pause so all your listeners can just embrace that. I mean, that's an incredible
underlined
thing.
In bold and highlighted.
In bold, get out your highlighter. I'm a teacher. Most diversity in America. I mean, that is magnificent. And to just describe what that means if you took a representative group of 20 people from Stockton, you'd have one Native American, 8 Latinx residents, 4 Asian Americans, 4 whites, 2 African Americans, and the one multiracial child of one of the highest rates of racial intermarriage in the country. I mean, that is a spectacular array of people. And the history that brought all of those people to Stockton is magnificent. It's this incredible story of California history, of global dislocation from war and various crises around the world. This incredible story of bravery and resilience, sort of making it to California. And then the history of the people that really helped build agriculture in California and really were the, you know, have been for generations some of the backbone of our food supply. And because the San Joaquin Valley, as your listeners know, is this critical breadbasket, not just for the Bay Area's food supply, but the world. You know, Stockton's people and the region's people have been so important to California ag. So this history is really inspiring. It's rooted in stories of Stockton's early commitment to freedom of religion that allowed a lot of different kinds of people to worship in the city. But, you know, that level of diversity has also had it's a tremendous challenge. And Stockton's history is stained by tremendous violence, by deep racial segregation, by a lot of racist conflict and exclusion. So it's a difficult history, but it's also a deeply American one that I think we have a lot to learn from.
How did your research and the conversations that you had for this book deepen your understanding of what ultimately led the city of Stockton to file for bankruptcy a decade ago?
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, on the surface, so many of your listeners know that the surface story of Stockton's bankruptcy was the foreclosure crisis and just getting slammed by the recession itself. And that's true. Stockton got slammed by the recession and the foreclosure crisis took a terrible toll on families there. But that recession came as a shock to a city that already had this much deeper intergenerational problem of tremendous racial segregation and very concentrated poverty in parts of the city, sort of behind those racially segregated lines. And the crack epidemic that had raged in so many cities in America, including Stockton, led to peak levels of violence in the early 90s. And that's sort of peak homicide rates nationwide. And Stockton Stockton at that time had, you know, really took this crisis so hard. And there were a whole generation of kids that were victims and witnesses to that crisis, a whole generation of neighborhoods that were really traumatized by that drug crisis. And I think for, you know, Stockton, like many cities, answered that crisis primarily with incarceration. And so you got a generation of kids that were also orphaned by the loss of fathers to incarceration or the loss of loved ones to homicide or to drugs. And that larger problem, I think, in many cities, including Stockton, was never ministered to in a loving way. There was just a kind of hit harder sort of answer to that crisis. Anyway, fast forward, and you know, the children of that crisis are in their 20s, and I think there's just this breathtaking social movement in Stockton to really care for current children, to care for youth in the city, to care for parents who are trying to be better parents than they had, and really sort of take care of the underlying scar tissue and trauma that have come with concentrated violence over so many years.
You know, when talking about violence and crime and incarceration and also just the financial woes of this city, I mean, those often make headlines. I'm just curious, what impact does this narrative have on a society, as you're describing, going through trauma and what could arguably be called destructive journalism?
You know, that the narrative is so important. I think we can throw that word around as though it's just sort of the way we talk, but it's actually really destructive when we tell stories that cities like Stockton are, quote unquote, the most miserable place to live, or, you know, corrupt politicians and bullets flying and, you know, broken people and so forth. These kinds of stories really build up as a form of hopelessness and despair in local politics, and also just in families and kids of sort of, what do I have to expect for my future? You know, what is this place where I live? And, you know, in the book, I tell some more private stories of what that's like to grow up as a kid in a place that the world is constantly ragging on and, you know, putting down. And the incredible thing about the social movement that I wrote about in Stockton is that people are really rebuilding and deepening these networks of people who look out for each other, this sort of ferocious loyalty and friendship and fun sometimes, you know, just really working together to sort of make a place, a community, and help rebuild some of that damage. And you watch how these vicious cycles of hopelessness start to shift toward a more virtuous cycle of accomplishments, like one little thing at a time. And then 5 years later, you've got quite a list and some real relationships of people who are used to leaning on each other, cooperating, working together. And you just start to see a lot of positive momentum. And I think in the 2016 to 2020 period, which is mostly what I focus on in the book, Stockton had a lot of really incredible momentum that way.
Yeah, we're talking about the perception versus the reality and the progress that's being made. What strikes you about this movement from residents who are very passionate about their community and the effect that they're having on potentially local government and the decisions they make, especially when it comes to investing in the city and underserved and neglected parts of the city?
There has been really important progress in some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. But it's interesting, this word impact, you know, effect, impact, these are really important words to focus on in local politics, because, you know, so much of local politics tries to deliver a quick return, right? Like, oh, we can redevelop a new movie theater and we can cut a ribbon on the new movie theater and we can all take a picture of that and feel great about the progress that's being had. It's much harder to see instant returns on anti-trauma work or on caregiving for families after long-term violence. And so, you know, you're not going to get, you know, photogenic moments of great kind of impact that happen quickly. And that was something, you know, it's so beautiful to spend time with the residents of Stockton who are really involved in this work, because they understand that a lot of their work is not going to, you know, it's seeds that are being planted for the long term and for the future of the city. Michael Tubbs, when he was mayor, he was a really important and I think incredibly effective mayor in Stockton. And he really tried to focus a lot of his administration on getting the rates of trauma in the city down, of really focusing on healing and mental health services for individuals and families. And, you know, you're just not going to see a lot of splashy immediate stats from that kind of investment, but it is the, it's what has to happen if you're serious about intergenerational poverty. There's no shortcuts that allow us to just will that problem away.
Yeah. And Stockton isn't alone in this. There are places across the country that face similar issues of poverty. What lessons do you think local governments can learn from places like Stockton in how, if they're overcoming perhaps mismanagement and maybe even redefining what a priority is to them?
Yeah, well, here I just want to invite folks to picture this mayoral conference room in Lawrence, Massachusetts, this amazing little town, also totally pathologized in its region. If you're in Boston, you think of Lawrence, Massachusetts as, you know, this incredibly poor city, mismanaged, very violent. Former President Trump often referred to it as the cause or the driver for the opioid crisis. So it's constantly sort of in that region for bad news. And yet there's amazing people in Lawrence doing such good work. And in the mayoral conference room, former Mayor Dan Rivera had this whiteboard. And on the whiteboard, he had written a message to himself and his staff to just remind himself of sort of what they were doing every single day. And he said at the top, the message said, "Do something. Can we do it today?" I said that in blue. And then in red, it said, "Stop explaining the problem, start explaining the solution." And at the bottom, his wife had written in green, "Keep your head up." And I thought that kind of summarized a lot of the work in Stockton too, a lot of the good work that has to happen everywhere, which is like, just do something. There's all kinds of things that local governments cannot control, the opioid crisis being one, things that are just giant forces that are beyond a local government's realm of authority. But people can sort of wrap their arms around their neighbors, their neighborhood, specific programs, really getting involved in their community. And that's, you know, you have to have a ground game like that. You can't simply solve big public policy problems from the top down. There has to constantly be a healthy synergy of activism at all levels of government. So I loved Dan Rivera's message that way of sort of, we just have to keep going. We just have to keep doing things. And Stockton has had, you know, really a generation of people that have showed up for that work in ways that I find just deeply moving.
Yeah. As you mentioned, planting seeds as opposed to, you know, that the ribbon cutting ceremonies and making that true difference. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Michelle Wild Anderson is an urban law professor at Stanford University, discussing her new book, The Fight to Save the Town, and how cities like Stockton have been discarded in today's modern economy. Still ahead, a Tony Award-winning musical takes the stage. The Woodland Opera House joins us about opening its season with In the Heights. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A Tony Award-winning musical and major motion picture will take the stage this weekend in Yolo County. The Woodland Opera House is opening their season with In the Heights, based on the book by Kiara Alegría Udes and transformed into a Broadway musical by Lin-Manuel Miranda. In the Heights showcases the thriving migrant community of Washington Heights in Manhattan, incorporating Caribbean rhythms, hip-hop, and traditional music ballads to tell the story of a predominantly Latinx and Black neighborhood. The lead character is Usnavi de la Vega, the owner of a bodega, a small Spanish grocery store, following his ambitions, struggles, and longing for a home. Joining us now is Jacob Gutierrez Montoya, director and choreographer for the musical at the Woodland Opera House. Good morning, Jacob. Thanks for making the trip.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You are a busy, busy bee. In addition to coordinating In the Heights at Woodland Opera House, you're also the founder and artistic director of the Sacramento Contemporary Dance Theater, artistic director of Hawkins Contemporary Jazz Company. How do you balance all these creative juices and obligations and passions?
That is a great question. It takes a lot of planning and it takes a lot of help. I've got great assistants that come with me to different projects and really lift me up so I can lift up all these other projects. So it's kind of how I make it happen. It's a balancing act, but it's something that I love and wouldn't have it any other way.
What led to you selecting In the Heights to be produced and now performed at Woodland Opera House?
Actually, the Woodland Opera House reached out to me and said, we really want to do In the Heights and we really want you to be the director and the choreographer. And so I said, of course, absolutely. summer is a great time for me to put my passion and put my energy towards a project like this because I'm not teaching at the other school. Mm-hmm. So I have a little bit of extra time. So that's kind of how it happened. And I am so excited for this weekend.
I can imagine. I mean, there's a major motion picture. Obviously, it's a Tony Award winning musical by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Did you feel any added pressure for taking on such a historic and popular musical turned movie?
No, actually, this is my third time being a part of the production.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with it. The pressure in it is to tell the story authentically and correct every time, creating an important environment for the artist to give that story to, you know, the theater. And so I feel like the pressure was more of a, how do I reinvent what I've already done at certain points? But I think that I feel like I've rose to the occasion and Friday's here.
How does your personal and lived experience kind of resonate with you in staying true to the heart of this musical, In the Heights?
Well, growing up, I've got half my family's Scottish, half my family's Mexican. and so I kind of had this dichotomy of who I was growing up. And so I think later, flash forward a long time, I wasn't able to really celebrate a lot of my Latinx heritage as a young person. And then I married the most incredible man, Elio Gutierrez Montoya, who plays Usnavi, actually.
Oh, playing the lead role.
He's playing the lead role. there was no politics in that. So he is a first-generation immigrant to the United States. And I've really been taught a lot through his experience of immigrating here and becoming a citizen and that. Mm. You know, leaving something behind for a better life, but also then longing for home.
Yeah.
I think there is searching for your new home. What is home? That is the question of the show for me.
Given that Woodland has a large portion or even majority of a Latino population, how do you hope this musical resonates with residents who will be watching it this weekend?
I hope they see themselves on stage. I hope they see their experiences on stage. I hope it uplifts them. I hope they feel heard and seen and loved by us putting on this production. I think it takes seeing yourself on stage to make some change, especially generational change. So I hope for that.
We're talking about a neighborhood that is, you know, Latino and Afro-Latino. I mean, there's so many countries and cultures that goes into this. When that translates into music, I imagine you must have had so much fun going from like hip hop to Caribbean music styles and even traditional music ballads.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Hopefully you get to come see it so you can see exactly what it is. But we had such a great time. The dancers are off the charts. Dancers from all over the Sacramento area, all skilled in different things. And yeah, it was a really important element to have everybody be able to be versatile in that sense, especially because this is one of those musicals. It's one of the only Latin musicals besides the classic of West Side Story that has Latin rhythms. And so I think it tells that story through the music by itself. So it was a lot of fun.
What went into collaborating and coordinating the choreography to go along with this music?
So the choreography is part of the storytelling. So it's in fact, I feel like the directing and the choreography kind of go, they're married pair. So you can't really tell the story without integrating the movement into the blocking, into each choice every actor is making. So I think the collaboration is like an absolute must. I think you can't do a separate type of idea. So, and I have an incredible assistant choreographer, Ashton Titus, who has helped me kind of be two people at once.
How have rehearsals been going? How have you been left feeling leaving rehearsals? Now you're just only about like 2 days from opening night.
Oh my gosh. It has been inspiring and of course long hours, right? So we are up against that deadline of we're opening and I think we're actually in a really beautiful place. I leave feeling like everyone is growing each night and I think that's all I can really ask for at this moment. It's going to be a beautiful show.
When people take in the musical and leave this weekend, how do you want them to feel when they leave?
I want them to feel nostalgic, but I want them to also feel hopeful. I want them to feel alive and I think and inspired.
What do you love about the Woodland Opera House?
I you know, this is my second show there. And so I love the support of the Woodland Opera House. I feel like I have a lot of visions. And so every time I ask for something new, you know, there's also a budget limit. I feel like we might have gone past that. But at this point, I think I feel supported. And I feel like the whole cast has that sentiment.
You mentioned that your partner is the lead role. What was it like working with your partner on this musical? Or have you done it before?
Yeah, we've worked together in the past. We actually met during a production of Rent years and years ago. But he is a remarkable wealth of knowledge when it comes to stage presence, when it comes to, you know, giving to each other on stage, acting, you know, and he just really does know also this part very well. Mm. So it's really beautiful to watch.
How far back do you go in the local Sacramento, Yolo County, or just the greater Sacramento creative scene here, given that your hands are in a lot of creative pots?
Yeah, so I went away to school in Las Vegas, and I came back around 2010. And so 2010 to now, I've really established some roots. I kind of felt like this is home for me. And so I want to make Sacramento as much of a thriving art scene as I possibly can. So about, 12 years? But really, my training also stems from here. So I went to a million different dance studios as a kid, did all the different like theater companies. And so here we are. I'm kind of giving it back.
Given that it's been about a decade or so, how has the arts and culture scene for you and your perspective evolved in Sacramento?
I think it's evolved a lot. I think there's a lot more theater companies and a lot more theater companies that are doing important and relevant work and not sticking to just the classics, which I love the classics, don't get me wrong. I think that they're history and they're important, but I think we have to keep theater pushing forward. And so I think a lot of theater companies are doing that. They're allowing for space for BIPOC communities to have important voices in the theater company, in Sacramento. So I'm very, very happy about the direction we're going. We can't go backwards, everybody.
Going forward. Finally, how many days, if you can just share the timeline, opening night is Friday, but how many opportunities do people have to watch In the Heights in Woodland?
So there's 4 weekends, and there's 3 performances a weekend, so I guess that would be 12. And they play at 7:30 on Fridays and Saturdays, and 2 o'clock on Sundays.
2 o'clock on Sundays. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I guess any parting words when people get prepared to take you in this weekend?
Come with an open heart. Come with some excitement in those feet. Be ready to move and dance and be ready to kind of tear up and be emotional.
I love the energy, Jacob. Thank you so much for
thank you
for making the trip down here. Jacob Gutierrez Montoya is a director and choreographer for In the Heights. The musical debuts at the Woodland Opera House on Friday and runs through the month. That is it for today. You can learn about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow, but in the meantime, we're going to get you warmed up with some music from In the Heights. Every day is different, so I'm switching up the beat, because my parents came with nothing. They got a little more, and sure we're poor, but yo, at least we got the store. And it's all about the legacy they left with me, it's destiny. And one day I'll be on the beach with Sonny writing checks to me. In the Heights, I hang my flag upon display. We came to work and to live, and we got a lot in common. It reminds me that I came from miles away.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.